Welcome to 7 Things EMS, a continuing education offering from Limmer Education. 7 Things EMS is designed to give you what you need to succeed in EMS. It's conversational, informational, and without the fluff.
And welcome to another 7 Things EMS episode. My name is Dan Limmer from Limmer Education. We have another great episode planned here. 7 things your therapist wants you to know. And sometimes working in EMS, there are things that your therapist probably should be telling you. We're going to talk about those today with Emily Riley. Emily is the mental health coordinator for New Orleans EMS, the New Orleans EMS that we've all seen from Night Watch fame. She's a licensed professional counselor with extensive experience dealing with veterans and first responders, starting in Orlando, Florida, and dealing with some of the fallout from the Pulse nightclub shooting. She's been involved in starting peer support teams for fire departments and is the counselor for New Orleans EMS. And I'd like to welcome you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, this part of our thing here is to have no fluff, right? We get into 7 things. EMS people want things to go. But I want to just address quickly first this night watch phenomenon. There's people there that have star or cult status, you know? And I think when people find out it's New Orleans EMS, I might be remiss in not asking the question, how does that all come together, the night watch thing? I don't think necessarily anybody has issues with being an EMS star or whatever, but people are very engaged with New Orleans, with the community, the people, and the calls they get. So tell me a little about that.
Sure. So I came in after the latest night watch filming. So with that caveat, I haven't been here for the bulk of the night watch episodes, but from what I do know and have seen of the show, I think you see a few sides of New Orleans come out. You know, you see this culture where people come together and they help each other and they do what they can for their neighbor. And then you also see the side that's really harsh and difficult, where the calls are intense and the intense calls happen frequently. And that kind of thing, I think, absolutely takes a toll on our people over time. So it really speaks to the level of care that they provide and the frequency at which they provide that care for the city.
Yeah, real high acuity, sometimes very violent, some stressful things.
Absolutely.
Well, I think that there's probably no better way to lead into our first of 7 things. And you wanted to talk about PTSD, and that PTSD is real. I think some think it's a little amorphous or it couldn't happen to them, but I think it's probably more common and affects more people than we realize.
I think that's absolutely true. You know, when I got started in the field 15 years ago, there was a lot more skepticism about PTSD than there is now, thankfully. I think the message is getting out there that PTSD is real, but a lot of people still think that it is exclusively a military thing because the military gets the grant money for the big research studies. And they're the ones who talk about it a lot now, which is wonderful and right. And the military needs to talk about it. But we also need to get the message out that first responders get PTSD too. EMTs, paramedics absolutely see traumatic things, sometimes multiple times every shift, right? And that takes a toll no matter how well you deal with your trauma. And so a lot of people in this field will develop PTSD. And when we start to recognize that as a real thing, we can connect people to care that's going to help them to deal with those trauma symptoms and to stay in the career that they love and just be whole human beings. You know, I don't see any downside to acknowledging that PTSD is real.
Yeah, well, let's lead that into symptoms. That was something that you wanted to talk about. I think people don't always know what it looks like, whether it's themselves or a partner or a friend, or it happens to people obviously outside of EMS too. What does PTSD look like?
Yeah, so symptoms really exist on this continuum. It's not this discrete category of you have it or you don't. You can have mild, moderate, severe symptoms, can be all over the place. And the symptom clusters that we talk about are re-experiencing, avoidance, to sound really clinical for a minute, negative alterations in cognition and mood, and hyperarousal. So to break those down a little bit, the re-experiencing symptoms are when your stressful or traumatic event kind of pops into your head when you don't want it to. So you're not trying to think about that call or those calls that are bothering you. It just comes up. Maybe you pass the place where it happened, or maybe you deal with something similar. Maybe you just have a nightmare about it. But it's images or thoughts of this stressful event that are popping into your head and not really under your control so much. And because those can be really difficult to deal with, people generally try to avoid that as much as possible. So the avoidance symptoms look like trying to stay away from anything related to those memories. That can be a little bit hard for you all, you know, for paramedics and EMTs. You can't avoid the intersection with that terrible car crash because it's part of your job to keep responding, right? So a lot of the avoidance is either crowds, a lot of people with PTSD and without, but a lot of people with trauma symptoms have a really hard time in crowds. So we'll see people who used to be okay, you know, going to a concert with their partner, and now all of a sudden they're like, I'm not going to do that anymore. Or you see this like internal avoidance where a memory pops up and it feels really difficult and really threatening, and you don't want all of that emotion, or maybe you feel like you can't handle it. And so you do whatever you can to push that down and avoid thinking about it. And that's a little bit different than just not wanting to think about it. You know, I think most of us don't really want to think about the difficult things that have happened to us. But if you don't have PTSD and some sort of difficult event is triggered, people generally kind of deal with that and move on without this desperate like push to not think about what's going on.
Now, talk about the hyperarousal. That's something I think sometimes we see that in people as we work with them. Mm-hmm. That's something we can see.
Yeah, I think sometimes the hyperarousal feels a little bit safer to talk about, and it is also easier to see. So that's, you know, the stereotype of someone hears a firework and they hit the floor because it sounds like a gunshot. That's the more extreme end of hyperarousal. But you also see things like people just being on guard more than usual, taking risks that they wouldn't normally take. And that could be driving, that could be spending money, that could be substance use, that could be gambling. It can be all sorts of risky behavior. And another one that falls under this category is difficulty sleeping. And that's one that a lot of people in the past have come to me and said, oh, I can't sleep. I have trouble sleeping. And I think this idea of insomnia or difficulty sleeping can sometimes be an easier way to open the conversation about what's going on.
All right. Well, I think we'll weave through some of these things as we continue to go on, looking at our seven things we're going to do. The next thing we're going to talk about is burnout. And I think people have trouble differentiating burnout from other things and PTSD and what happens. I think that somehow there's probably some relation, but the next thing is about burnout. Let's identify what burnout is and what to do about it.
Yeah, so burnout is this idea that you just have a hard time caring the way that you used to care. This fatigue, cynicism, maybe not as committed to the job anymore. Maybe you don't feel a sense of achievement or fulfillment while you do your job. Maybe you just feel like you don't have empathy, don't really care about your patients anymore the way you used to. Like, you're kind of just going through the motions and not getting any sort of enjoyment or personal benefit out of it. Burnout is also incorporates this idea of emotional exhaustion. And that can happen when you work in this field for long enough, and long enough is different for everybody, right? But a lot of people will hit this point where they've been dealing with these heavy things for so long and taking on the emotions of patients and families at every single call that they take. And that can be exhausting. And one way the brain reacts to that is to just kind of shut down and say, I'm just not going to care. I'm just not even going to go there anymore because it's too much. So the things you might notice in yourself are being snappier or more irritable with patients or with their families, getting angrier about some of the less stressful calls or those calls where you think, did this person really need an ambulance? And it can be harder to stay patient with those sorts of things, especially if you're burnout. Another one that I've heard before are, you know, if someone goes to work and then they just sit in their car because they don't want to get out and get started with the shift, where it just feels like this sense of dread and just not looking forward to work anymore. If you're feeling those things, then you're burned out, and the best thing to do is to find some way to take a break. It can be some days off of work. It can be a little vacation. And sometimes I've had people shift their role within EMS. So maybe there's a way to get more involved in the educational side of things, or maybe there's a way to get off the truck and out of the streets and just doing something else in EMS, at least for a little bit. And those sorts of things can really help with burnout too.
Now there's, it almost sounds like we're talking a little bit about, you know, caregiver fatigue and that burnout and some of those things, I guess, use that term. But one of the things you also hear about is that sometimes the employment, I'm not saying about this about New Orleans, but sometimes EMS employment itself isn't easy. Politics and pay and hours and just elements, non-patient care elements of the job itself, I think can also take a toll. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I think sometimes that can be harder than the patient care aspect as well. You know, sometimes and this is, again, not talking about New Orleans, just my experience. Throughout my whole career, people kind of feel like, just let me show up and do my job and not have to do the rest of it. I don't want to deal with the politics or whatever. And one thing that I've suggested, and I have to give my mother credit for this because she suggested it to me when I was in grad school, is to keep some sort of record of the moments that are meaningful for you, whether it's on the notes app in your phone or a folder or someplace you write down positive patient outcomes or the time a patient thanks you or just whatever makes this job meaningful. Keep it all in one place. And then when the other stuff starts to get to you and you start to feel like, is this worth it? You can go back to your list and look at all those moments where you've really felt fulfilled and like you've had an impact and you're making a difference. And that can help a lot of people push through all the other stuff and remember why they got in this field in the first place.
Yeah, I did a lot of time doing police work as well as EMS. And times I struggled in police work, and I found a disconnect when you tried to convince yourself you didn't care when you really do, right? You're just trying to tell yourself you don't care, but ultimately you're passionate about your job. You're doing what you worked hard to get into. And I think that conflict gets very challenging. I think some of that is burnout when you get to a certain point when you're trying to tell yourself that you don't care, but you want to care. That conflict I always found very challenging. And identifying it, I think, helped.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad that you were able to sort that out.
You sound like a therapist right there. That's very good. Just throw a little bit of the Limmer psychology in there as well. Let's go on to number three. Sometimes we cope well, but sometimes not. there are healthy ways that we can deal with the things we're talking about and some unhealthy ways. And that is thing number three.
Yep, absolutely. We all know drinking, other drugs, emotional eating, reckless behavior, all that stuff. Those are common ways that people cope, and they're also not helpful and not healthy. But we do it because our brains want dopamine. When you go through something difficult or stressful, dopamine makes you feel better. And what gives you that really quickly, oftentimes it's unhealthy things. So there's a reason why a lot of people have that tendency.
It's easy.
It's easy. It's easy and it's quick, right?
And that's who EMS is, right? We like that instant gratification. We go to calls. We don't have desks with work piled up. You know, it's adrenaline driven. And that's, I think, is a thing.
Yep. And you have to keep going. So you might as well, one can understand how you might think, you might as well just pick something that's going to help you real quick so you can just keep going real quick. But over time, that's going to backfire and end up being detrimental to your health, mental health, and physical health in your overall well-being. Another one that we don't really think about as unhealthy coping is isolation. In EMS, you know, you're dealing with people all day long. It's understandable if you want to go home and just not deal with anybody at all in your off time. But our brains are wired for social connections. We actually experience physical effects when we are isolated, even if we don't feel lonely. So it is super important to maintain healthy emotional connections with people that you care about and make sure that you're not withdrawing completely and going completely into sleeping all the time or drinking away the shift or emotional eating or whatever it is. To shift that into a healthy perspective, I mean, we all have our vices, right? I'm not saying that you can never have a drink after a rough day. Sure. Yeah. But you don't want to go overboard. You need to make sure that you're balancing all that stuff that feels good immediately with the stuff that's healthy over time, the stuff that's going to keep your brain and your body healthy and well and keep you feeling like a whole human being. So making sure that you are taking care of your brain and your body in all those different ways is so beneficial. You know, we talk a lot about going to therapy, and I think a lot more people should go to therapy than do. I also think that we don't talk enough about the impact of good nutrition and sleep and a little bit of exercise and some healthy social connection in terms of coping and mental health, because those four things can make an enormous difference in how you're feeling.
And I think I'd like you to maybe address, you know, the, you see on social media, you know, somebody is lost to suicide and people say, I just didn't know. And people will say, you know, it's very important to reach out to others. What would you say to a partner, to a friend, to a spouse, somebody listening to this? What would you do when the person, and I can see somebody wants to crawl into their hole after seeing a lot of stuff, they kind of want to be alone, but that social support and connection is important. How do we support somebody? How do we identify that? How do we support them? How do we know what's enough and when we should?
Yeah, that's tough because it can be different for everyone. So I think, and a little bit of disconnection is fine. Also, I want to make that clear too. It's okay to disconnect from everybody sometimes, but staying in that place is what is really difficult and can be harmful over time. So if you have a loved one who you feel like is isolating too much, I think the first thing to do is to have a conversation with them about it. And hopefully they'll be open to that and figuring out and able to figure out, well, what amount of disconnection and isolation is healthy and where's my line to where it becomes harmful. But I think you have to be gentle and persistent if someone you love is in this isolated place, because pushing too hard can alienate people more, of course. But if you don't do anything, then maybe they're going to stay there longer than they would have otherwise. So
I think the concept, I mean, everyone has been in tough spots. Just the concept of somebody calling to check on you is hopeful that you've got something mm-hmm. outside. I think having hope is important. Having that person without even being a pest. I don't think people always understand what little gestures mean when it comes down to someone's well-being. Even if you're not fully engaging, knowing someone is there, I think, has value.
Absolutely. You know, there's a meme floating around I've seen recently that says something about introverts don't want to actually go to the thing they're being invited to, but they want to be invited. It makes me chuckle. And I think there's so much truth to that. Even if your loved one is not taking you up on going for a walk or playing a game together, even if they're sitting there on the couch on their phone and don't want to talk, knowing that there's someone there who cares and is still trying is hugely beneficial. Just getting a text from your partner at work that says, hey, hope you're doing all right, or whatever it is, can really make a huge difference for people.
All right. Let's go on to number four. You know, I got to tell you, every EMS textbook has got some of this stuff in it about how stress affects the body and the fight, flight, freeze, whatever they're saying. And I think you have the ability to explain that more and more relevantly than just reading it or something that you see in a CE session. Tell us about how stress hurts us.
Sure. So just a quick reminder, I'm sure you all know this part better than me, but you have the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system. And when something stressful happens, your sympathetic nervous system activates to help you deal with that stressor, right? That's the fight, flight, freeze, or fawn, I believe they're including now. And once you deal with the stressor, people generally think that that system is done. But actually, what we need to be doing is dealing with the stress. Because way back in the day, I like to say, when we were cavemen and hunting and gathering, when the stressor was resolved, the stress was gone too. If we were being chased by an animal and we deal with that animal, then there's no more stress. But modern day is not like that anymore. We get stressors all the time, every day, and they're not necessarily life-threatening, but our brains don't know that. And that stressor can go away. You know, you can have a tough conversation with your boss, and then that conversation's over, but that stress is still there. And so what we need to be doing is doing something to bring the parasympathetic nervous system back online, because that's going to balance it out. That's going to help you deal with the actual stress. That sympathetic response is what brings up a lot of our trauma symptoms, a lot of the depression symptoms, burnout, exhaustion, even stuff like GI symptoms. There are all sorts of physical problems that come up from too much sympathetic activation. So when you can activate your parasympathetic instead, you're teaching your body and your brain that you are safe and you're dealing with that stress. You're letting your body know the stressor is gone, the stress is done, I'm good to go. And that is what can help a lot of these symptoms resolve, both the mental health ones that we think about and these physical ones. Ways okay. to do that are all the stereotypical things that therapists say all the time, are breathing, exercises, meditation, yoga. But I always tell people to find a way that works for you. Like, my father-in-law is a retired law enforcement up in Wisconsin. He worked in Milwaukee for his career, and now he lives in the middle of nowhere, Wisconsin. he's not a yoga guy, but what he is a hunting guy, and he will go out and sit in nature and just breathe and clear his mind. And he says, like, there are some days it doesn't even matter if there's a deer. And that's one way that he really brings his parasympathetic nervous system back online, whether he knows he's doing it or not. So it doesn't have to look the way therapists say. You can kind of play with this and figure out what's going to work for you, but you need to figure out something that's going to be calming and like an antidote to the stress.
All right. So that kind of rolls us into number five, which is all trauma can be treated. And we try and treat, you know, physical trauma as part of the EMS job, but emotional trauma, you know, can be treated. This isn't a permanent sentence. This isn't something that you have to live through forever. We can treat this emotional trauma, and you're going to tell us a little bit about how.
I would love to. That's one of the number one of the very few things, if people take nothing else from this podcast, I would like people to know that PTSD and trauma symptoms can be treated. Because so many people, including some of my own friends, think that their PTSD just is, and they're sentenced to it, and it's how they have to live forever. And that's not the case. We have a lot of treatments out there that have been shown to be really effective. And I've done these treatments with a lot of first responders and a lot of veterans, and they can work beautifully. We're hearing a lot about EMDR these days. I think that's probably the biggest one and the most well-known treatment. EMDR can be fantastic. Two others that don't get as much attention.
Before you go on, Emily, will you just explain the EMDR, just the letters behind it, what it means,
the
eye movement and how it goes? No, it's because that really is a very promising thing that's talked about a lot right now.
So EMDR stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And the idea is that going through PTSD is kind of a disorder of forgetting, we say a little bit. So you have these memories that are just sort of stuck, and something is keeping them stuck and replaying in your brain. And so the idea behind EMDR is that you can process these in a specific way, and the eye movements will bring out, I believe it's theta waves in your brain that help with that reprocessing and kind of get the traumatic memories to settle, for lack of better term. It's not erasing memories. It's not trying to take away what happened. It's just getting them to a place where they can rest with your other memories so that you can go on and live your life and you don't feel trapped by your trauma any longer.
People shouldn't be afraid of it. It's a proven therapy. It seems that the eye movement and the combination might make somebody skeptical about how that actually works, but it works.
Yeah. And to be honest, I used to be one of those people who was a little bit skeptical. I was trained primarily in exposure therapy, which is very similar to EMDR, but without the eye movements. And so I just thought, well, it's just exposure therapy and the eye movements don't add anything. And I don't know that is fair for me to say any longer. And either way, EMDR is very, very well studied in lots of different populations with PTSD, and in first responders and in military and in civilians with childhood trauma, with sexual trauma, you name it. There's been an EMDR study, and the results have been shown to be very effective. And a good EMDR therapist is also going to let the client set the pace. So you don't have to feel like you're being thrown into this thing and you have to talk about all the difficult stuff until the therapist stops poking and prodding. The therapist should be working with you to help you figure out what you can tolerate, and you are in control the whole time and you get to say, okay, no, this is enough today. This is my limit. So I think it's really wonderful in that it gives control to the client or the patient about their experiences, and they get to guide their own therapy. And that's a really empowering thing when you feel like these memories have kind of hijacked your brain and they're taking control of you, to be able to take that control back, I just think it's wonderful. So I am now very, very much in favor of EMDR, along with the other evidence-based trauma therapies, which there are several others.
And you mentioned exposure and CPT in your notes preparing for this.
Yes. So exposure therapy is based on the idea that your PTSD, re-experiencing memories, are bringing up lots of anxiety, and that when you avoid all those memories, what you're doing is teaching your brain that to be safe, you have to avoid thinking about the difficult thing. And so you're trapped in this cycle where it's memory, huge amount of anxiety, avoidance. And then that avoidance just kind of expands, kind of like a spider web almost, and that more and more things become connected to your trauma. And all of a sudden you're avoiding so much of your life, you're having trouble having a life at all. So the way that exposure therapy tackles this is with this idea that you can't be anxious about something forever. You cannot, our brains cannot sustain this huge adrenaline dump. So if you come into my office and we're going to do exposure therapy, then we do talk about your stressful event. You know, we'll sit down and go over what happened kind of from start to finish. And meanwhile, I'm going to be asking you to rate your anxiety, and eventually your anxiety is going to go down because our brains are built that way. It just has to. It's never failed me yet. So if you can think about that really difficult thing when your anxiety goes down and you do that enough times, it teaches your brain that you don't have to have that huge response when you think about it, and you don't have to avoid all these other things in your life. And from there, it's sort of this cascading effect that helps resolve all of the other PTSD symptoms as well. It's not as commonly talked about, but from my experience, it works really beautifully.
All right, and the last one, you had CPT.
Yes, stands for Cognitive Processing Therapy. And that one is kind of working on, if exposure works on the anxiety part of things, it's sort of a bottom-up process. CPT is working on things from a top-down process, so looking into thoughts and logic and what stories are you telling yourself because of the things that you've been through. You know, what beliefs do you have about yourself and the world and other people in life now because of your traumatic experiences? And trauma generally warps those, and people end up with really exaggerated beliefs about themselves and the world and how they can do their jobs and all sorts of things. And so CPT is designed to identify those and talk through them with people to find more realistic and more helpful ways of thinking about things. Generally, they talk a lot about stuck points, and that's finding the place, the points that are keeping you stuck in this trauma, the thoughts that you're having that are keeping it here and kind of making the traumatic experience haunt you. And when you can dismantle those, then it is really freeing. And generally, again, resolves PTSD symptoms. And the tough thing about this, I think, is that not all of these therapies are going to work for everybody. And right now, I don't know which to recommend. As far as I'm aware, there's nothing out there that says, okay, if your personality is like this or your symptoms are like that, you should be matched with EMDR versus CPT versus exposure or whatever. So it can be a little bit of a trial and error for people to find the therapy that's going to be really helpful. I know that can be frustrating for people. So I just want to let everyone know, if that is you, please don't give up. If you've tried one trauma therapy and you don't feel like it's working, don't give up. Just try another trauma therapy. Maybe the tools in CPT are not what's going to be helpful to you, but the reprocessing in EMDR is.
Would you say it's fair that the same thing might be said about a therapist? You have to find a therapist that you can work with that does the same thing?
Yes.
That finds a way to help you?
Yes, great point. You know, a lot of therapy is about the match between therapist and client and what that relationship is like. And you can have great outcomes even if you don't particularly love your therapist. I've talked to some people who feel that way, where they didn't feel like it was a great match, but they just kind of powered through for whatever reason and still felt like things got better. But I think when you have a really good match, it almost feels like magic, and it can be so wonderful in terms of helping people heal. So if you try therapy one time or go to a few sessions with someone and you're like, I don't know about this, keep trying. Try a different therapist, try a different modality. And we don't get offended if someone says it's not a good match. You know, we all understand that. We've all been there. I'm not going to be the personality for every single person in the world. And I know that. And I think we all do. So don't feel worried about offending your therapist if you say, hey, I really don't feel like this is a good match. I'm gonna move on and try somebody else. That's understandable. It happens a lot.
I think perception is important. I'll just share an anecdote. When I met you last year, you were in the process of moving your office from upstairs in the administration area to downstairs, more around the EMS providers. And that actually was something that apparently all decided was more important, that your perception needs to be isolated, not someone who's affiliated with administration. So even those little things make a difference. I just found that fascinating.
Absolutely. You know, I wasn't sure what difference it was going to make. For 6 months or so when I was upstairs, I was like right in the middle of administration. So you could get to my office through either end of the hallway, but either way, you had to walk by a bunch of other admin offices. A lot of the admins started telling me, and our people on the streets were like, this is not going to work. People don't want to walk past administration to get to you. Even though I think our administration has been wonderfully supportive of mental health, they've been very welcoming to me and very open about asking people to come talk to me when they think that needs to happen. There's still some sort of wall there that makes people think, I just don't want them to know that I'm going to see Emily. So they moved me downstairs, and I'm right kind of in the middle of all of it, where the crew's close to where they clock in and out. I get to go hang out during shift change a little bit. I get to small talk with people. My door's often open. I have a bowl of candy and a coffee machine. I invite people just to come in and get a piece of candy and chat. It doesn't have to be a therapy session, you know? And I think those things have made it a lot easier for people to then come and say, like, okay, but can we close the door? Can we have a real talk now? And it's awesome. It's been wonderful to be down here and really integrated a little bit more with everybody to see what impact that's had. I've had a lot more people being willing to come talk.
That's great. Well, as we go, the number 6 and 7, we're kind of coming back around to things we talked about. In number 6, the concept is taking a break, the relevance of rest and a break for your brain and your body.
Yes. So I preach this so much. I think people here are maybe a little bit tired of hearing me say it, but we all need breaks. And I think first responders in general, EMS specifically, can have this idea of like, well, if not me, then who? Like, I have to put myself on the back burner and I have to keep pushing because there are people out there who need me. Right? And what's going to happen if I take a break? And I think there are also people who say, when I'm so focused on work, I can keep all my personal stuff or all of my mental health concerns on the back burner. And the second I stop, all of that's going to come to the surface and I'm just going to fall apart. And I think between those two camps, you get a lot of people who don't want to take breaks, but our brains need it. If you don't stop, eventually a lot of people in neuroscience will say the brain pushes back. It can, and it does, and it's going to force you to take a break somehow. So you might as well take planned breaks along the way to rest and recharge, to reconnect with loved ones. It's doing all those things that are bringing your parasympathetic nervous system online and keeping you healthy. And that's helping you deal with trauma symptoms and process emotions and giving you some time to rest and just take a break from the constant stress. Our brains are
If the body knocks you down, it might not be pretty. If the body decides to stop you, that can be a problem.
Absolutely. This is not to equate my experience with what EMS goes through, because I know it's very different. But when I was in grad school the first time, we worked a lot and I was stressed all the time. And I was just always doing something related to school. And I got really exhausted and burnt out and got to the point where I was having trouble getting out of bed in the morning. And my husband now, then we were just dating, said to me, like, this is not you and this is not okay. And it kind of clicked then that I wasn't taking a break because I felt like I couldn't. And then my body was forcing it. I was getting a ton of migraines and I just couldn't engage anymore. And once I kind of took a couple weeks off for myself, thankfully it coincided with a school break, so I was able to take some time. That made a huge difference, and I was able to re-engage and remember why I got into this field in the first place.
Yeah, so that's it. You one of the things you said is that, you know, we let our muscles recover after a workout. You know, if we're doing some of the kind of strenuous stuff, we know that we can't physically be strenuous for a long period of time. But for some reason, it doesn't click with our brain when we're putting strain on our body and our emotions, that we don't seem to feel the need to take that break like we do with physical activity.
Yeah, I think a lot of us view rest as lazy. And we have this idea that to be worth or to be enough, to be worthy, to be something, we have to be earning it. We have to be productive. We have to be doing something. Especially EMS. I hear this a lot from people, you know, because there's always another call to take. But it is a cliche because it's true. You have to take care of yourself and let your brain recover and treat your brain the way you would your body if you really want to be the most effective and if you want to keep doing this long term.
Okay. Well, the last one, number seven, it's all about balance. And that is a foreign statement for a lot of EMS people. And I can speak from experience on that one. But the concept of your activities, goals, hobbies, your connections to things outside of EMS, it's easy to have those go by the wayside. EMS has, I don't want to use this term appropriately, but a little bit of addiction potential. You know, especially when you're new, you want to get in that. And you want to go on more calls. You want to do more stuff. You develop stories. You see things nobody else sees. And it can draw you in. And I think negatively affect that concept of balance, but hopefully not before it's too late.
Right. Absolutely. It can be hard to force yourself to be a little bit more balanced, especially in the beginning when you are so enthusiastic. But again, if you don't make sure that there's balance in your life, if you don't make sure that you have social connections outside of EMS and hobbies and activities and things that you care about in addition to this work, then eventually you're going to run yourself ragged. You're going to run yourself into the ground and just be exhausted. And that's a quicker way towards burnout too. I think the people who stay in this field for a long time and feel good about it are people who are able to find some sort of balance. You know, the people who are all EMS 100% of the time do tend to feel burned out a little bit quicker, I think. So a good way just to protect yourself against trauma symptoms, against burnout, depression, all of those really difficult things is to make sure that you have other things in your life that bring you fulfillment and joy and happiness.
right? You know, at the end of these sessions, we're coming up just, it's the perfect time. It's been a great conversation that I hope people get benefit from. New Orleans is pretty progressive having you there. I think there's a lot of people listening to this saying, you know, if we had a, you know, a therapist, a counselor that would be at briefings and someone I could stop in and just say hi to or close the door, as you say, and have a conversation. But I don't think that's the norm in a lot of places. How would you tell a person to make that first step to get help? It's kind of a way to close this down. What's the gateway into this? You know, people are probably hesitant to take that step and do it, whether it's concerned about what other people will think, what the administration will think, its weakness or whatever. But it's so important. You've laid out a beautiful plan. How do you take that step, and what do you do to get better if you feel you need it?
Sure. I think that probably the easiest way to find a therapist is by using the website Psychology Today. That's where most of the therapists in private practice I know put up profiles. And through that website, you can search people in your area. You can search for people who take your insurance, who specialize in trauma, who offer virtual or in-person therapy, depending on your needs. And that, I think it's a really great tool to be able to see who's available. And on Psychology Today, therapists will put up a little bit about themselves too. So you can kind of get this initial feel of like, okay, maybe I would get along well with this person, or I'm not really vibing with how they're describing themselves or their treatment. I don't think this is the person for me. There, you can also go through your insurance website through their provider search, and that way you will have easier access to people, just folks who you know are going to take your insurance. I do find through those websites, the profiles aren't quite as comprehensive, so you don't get quite as good of an idea of whether you might match with someone or not. But most therapists will be willing to have a quick consultation call with somebody before that initial appointment. So you can request that, and it can be, you know, a 10-15 minute phone call to have a conversation with them about what their treatment style is and how they might approach therapy with you, for you to figure out if it's a good match. One thing I do suggest to people is to ask their prospective therapist if they've worked with first responders before. That can be hard to find depending on the area that you're in. But I think if you find someone who's got first responder experience, that can be really beneficial. I've talked to several people who have been to see therapists in private practice who don't really understand the EMS world and have told people, well, you should just quit your job if it's that difficult. And that's, of course, not going to be helpful to somebody who wants to get better for themselves and so they can keep doing their job.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. I think, and there's a certain part of that that's just taking the step to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think people are actually much more understanding of it today than people would have been years ago. It's really not as foreign a thing as people think it is. I think people have to just make a step to do something when they need it, or help a friend or partner into it if they need it. I think that's just, you got to get people in the door.
Yes. What's really interesting to me is that I feel like the older generations still have a little bit of this, like, oh, well, I can't go to therapy kind of attitude. Like, it's a really hard step to make because it means something about you, that you're broken, or that it's bad to need help, or some sort of belief like that. The younger folks seem to have this idea that they're screwed up and everybody's screwed up and it just is what it is. And I'm like, no, yeah. We went too far. You still should go to therapy, because taking care of your mental health can help you deal with all these symptoms. So you don't just feel like, oh, well, I'm screwed up and there's nothing I can do about it. There are things that you can do about it. And if you have a loved one in your life who you really feel like needs help, sometimes it can be helpful for you to do that therapist search for them and say, hey, here's a list of five names who take your insurance. can you please start calling and get in there and just see how it goes? Because sometimes if you're really in that, if you're really depressed or you're really in the PTSD, it can be so overwhelming to even look through a website and figure out where to start. So that's a really great way to help a loved one, is to say, well, here's a place that you can start. Would you be willing to call these people and give it a try? I can't tell you how many times when I was working with veterans, I would have them come in and say, I'm here because usually it was a man in a heterosexual relationship. Usually they would say, my wife made me come in because she thinks I have PTSD and I'm here to prove that I don't. And I'd say, well, I have some news for you.
All right. I think that's a perfect wrap up. Some good advice that follows these amazing seven things. I think New Orleans EMS is very fortunate to have you, Emily Riley, the mental health coordinator and counselor there for them. And I want to thank you for taking your time to make this podcast. And I believe people will hear this and it will make a difference.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to a Seven Things EMS podcast by Limmer Education. If you've listened to this podcast on a streaming service and you're interested in getting continuing education credit, please go to lc-ready.com for more information.